The learning about a mature way to live is breathtakingly fast if it's allowed to occur. Here, let me show you one other picture here. What you're about to see, if I can find it, is a 7-year-old boy, an 8-year-old boy, he says, desperately leafing through these, and a 13-year-old boy on the Staten Island Ferry at the moment before they set out to ride across the United States on their bicycles. Now, they got a deal with their parents that once every 100 miles, they will check in. And that happens all the time. I mean, outside of our awareness, and maybe many of the people are in the room right in front of me, outside of our awareness, there are thousands of people who grow up in the United States a different way. And there's abundant evidence, if you go to the primary sources of American history, that a great many of the people who later had power in the society grew up a different way. Yes. It's a reciprocity. It happens both ways. I see something in the paper, the kid sees something in the paper, or the kid has some compelling need to move in a certain direction that's been muted in all the venues that the kid travels in. But if you listen, they'll all tell you. When people used to argue that there was a need to do testing, I would say that there cannot be a public school teacher with any brains in their head at all who at the end of the first day, from simply intensely watching the kids in front of them, doesn't know where they're going to score, even doesn't know a whole lot about their home life. So you listen to the kids. I would set myself the goal not of doing things for classes. Remember, I'm trying to declassify children. But for doing things for individual kids. If I see a kid who's mute and will not speak, I know that they are so badly damaged in the, you know, in the journey ahead of them, that nothing else should matter at all except giving them some audiences that they can speak before and develop the ability to swim like some noble fish through the human environments they're going to face. That does not heal itself as you get older. It gets worse. I mean, there are exceptions to that, but not many of them. And certainly by 13, there can't be many classes where other than 5 or 6 kids don't dominate the oral environment. I would get kids like that aside. I had one who's a lawyer now too, Larry Engelstein. I took him aside. I said, Larry, if you ever raise your hand in this class again or say anything, I said, I'm just going to destroy your grade, which for Larry meant getting a 96 instead of a 99 or something. I said, you already have mastered that trick. And for you to endlessly practice on people who are already your subjects is a waste of your time, and you're preempting time that belongs to people who need a safe environment to speak in. I saw Larry Engelstein 3 or 4 years ago, and he said, that one encounter, and I said, you know, I'll trade you, go out and find tough audiences, Larry, and they're not hard to find, and you know, and then hone your skills. He said it changed his life, being able to see himself with his little trick, doing the trick over, and we're all that way, you know, what works for us. At the end of a school year, I would often take whatever I had done that worked, just throw it away. I didn't want to think about it again. I wanted to always start from scratch and see people not as representatives of types, but as what they are, like their fingerprint, utterly unique. They each require a private and personal curriculum. There are certainly group things that are valuable to everybody. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. That's brilliant. What this lady said is these are spectacular stories. But when you, when you're compelled to be a performer in front of a workshop, people don't want to hear about little triumphs like Mae Moy, who had a brilliant understanding and sensitivity to the Chinese language, you know, and just sounded like some ignorant washerwoman in English. And I knew that Mae was capable, if not overnight, almost that quickly, of simply moving this feeling she had from one to the other. And I'd do that, but I'd talk to Mae after school, not about that. I mean, we would talk about ideas. And one day, Mae, and I don't know if this is a universal Chinese characteristic, but certainly in some of the Chinese immigrants in New York City, there's a kind of a really aggressive disdain. And Mae threw a poem down on my desk and went to her seat, and I looked at it, and I mean, tears would come to your eyes. This 13-year-old girl who wasn't even her own culture, and it was magnificently subtle and powerful. I knew immediately that I better not open my mouth about language in front of this girl, because she would put me in my place. With a mute kid, for that person to see that they have a right to be heard is a huge victory. Just with that, with somebody who is always whining, to realize that it doesn't hurt very much to get punched, even if someone beats you bloody. It doesn't hurt very, it really doesn't. What hurts is to constantly slink around. So, and I'll talk about this tomorrow, and in fact I picked that out as an incident, because the school environment in most places is brutal, regardless of what you see as parents. So that's a good school, they're okay. I mean, it really is like under the surface of a mill pond. I mean, these kids are always hitting each other in the kidney or saying something devastating that just ruins you. I mean, I would have to speak from a male point of view. But this whole idea that in holistic whole word exercises, you know, that you just take risks with language, not in front of that 7-year-old girl over there who you would, you know, just paralyze, your tongue swells up in your mouth. You're not going to take any risks. You're going to play it safe. And certainly not in front of the boy who lives to humiliate you when you get out in the play. You're not going to take these risks that... I know I'm a little bit off the subject here, but it's one of the great anomalies is that this great reading war that's taking place is just miscast. Inside a safe home environment where there's some love and you can take risks, you know, it works like a charm. I mean, it's hard to stop somebody from learning how to read. But you put people in a formal staged setting and pretend that it's the same. It's like pretending that a school teacher is a mother or father. You know, it's bunk. So there, he said. Yes, ma'am. Could you speak a little louder? And that's one of the tricks I would always use. I'd say you can say anything you want in the class, but you got to say it loud enough for everybody to hear. Ah, no, I don't want to. I mean, the answer is yes, but. This whole self-esteem stuff is, you don't deserve self-esteem until you have some sense of who you are and what your power is. And everybody has power, and everybody's somebody. But if you lay on, one of the most damaging things is to lay on praise that isn't earned. Obviously, if it's your own kid, you know, there is love and respect here that's mutual. But let the kids, now, kids will constantly bring you drawings, and I know what happens in homeschools as well as public schools, drawings that they've copied from comic books. You know, and they're not bad as imitations there, but at some point you have to point out that imitating someone else's art is not where it's at. It may be a stage on the way. I don't mean to put the kid down. When they do that, I'd say, look, what you've done. Yeah, that looks pretty much like Spider-Man and so on. But look, you've got the Spider-Man model in front of you, and you don't see that all the panels aren't the same size, that when they want to indicate speed, there might be three long, narrow, vertical panels in a row. You know, and when they want to stop the action of the reader's mind, they use the whole page, or they... Sometimes the guy's hand or his foot will go out of the barrier. I said, none of that's in there, and you were looking at it when you copied. But you were so frightened about violating the frame, so go back and look at it harder and make it a better copy, and then start thinking of your own ideas. There wasn't a year when my kids didn't besiege Marvel Comics and DC. I think DC's out of business, but I don't know that. And the editor of Marvel Comics lived in my building, and I was not loath to rat on that fact, but I taught kids discreet approaches. You know, I see, remember millions of kids, you know, sell the family home and migrate to New York so they can go to Marvel Comics. The last thing you want to see if you're in the comic business is a kid. You know. What could they possibly do except damage? I said, but you got to find a way to offer a quid pro quo. You must not ever ask for something unless you're really in duress, unless you have something to give in return. And kids will often say, but I don't have anything to give in return. And that's foolish. Simply close attention and their feedback is priceless stuff that market research firms charge through the nose for. There's a natural payoff in a kid who's intelligent and interested and passionate and respectful of what they're asking for. There's a natural payoff. The most unexpected thing about placing, there wouldn't be a year when every one of my kids wouldn't have either a long apprenticeship or a number of short apprenticeships. I thought that these would be extremely difficult to get, and by the third or fourth year there were way more people calling and saying, can you send more of these kids, than I had kids to distribute. It wasn't because I had awakened the milk of human kindness in their breast. It's because your kids have a currency to trade for what they're given. Just their attention and their intelligent questions. Haven't you had as parents the experience that I had regularly as a teacher, that the kid will see an aspect of something you know that you have not seen, and it'll deepen or broaden your own understanding? Look at what we've done to our so-called adult communities by bleeding all the children out of them during the workday and bleeding all the old people out of them. You only need to read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography to understand the vitality that crackled through colonial America when everybody virtually was a person mixing together. I don't know if that was an answer to the question. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, right. Okay, I am too. There's a whole variety of answers to that, but I'll give you a few definite ones. I heard you say you wanted your kid to take college courses. Did I hear that correctly? Is there anybody here who's not heard of Dr. John Baer? This would be worth the price of the whole conference, just by itself. And call him. I'll give you the town he lives in. Benicia, I think it's California. It's on the San Francisco Bay. Benicia. Baer has, for the last 30 years, been putting out a thick telephone book catalog called Guide to Alternative Ways to Go to College. I've made that up. You can buy it here? Oh, but if the 10-speed press one, I would not buy. Flatly. Baer sold his idea at a 10-speed press about 7 years ago, and 10-speed press has cut it way down to like 100 schools. You, for the same money, you can buy it directly from John Baer. And Bennessy, he retained the rights to sell the whole thing. Call him up and say, I want to buy one of them. You give me your visa thing, you'll get it. And I will tell you this. My daughter, who graduated from MIT and was making a lot of money for IBM and said, this is tremendously dull, but it'll get better, right? I said, no, you'll make a lot more money. It'll get duller. And she said she wanted to try school teaching for a couple of years. And I said, you've got about 20 to 36 of these insane pedagogical credits to take. I said, however, you can take them by mail, by correspondence from hundreds of schools in the United States. And so instead of paying Bank Street College $350 a credit and going for 2 years, which she wouldn't have done, she paid Penn State $75 a credit and got all whatever it was, 30 or whatever it was, in 6 months, and told me that she had learned more from doing it that way than she'd learned from any course she ever took at MIT. So she got her teaching license instantly, much, much cheaper. And furthermore, I didn't have a 10-year-old kid who go. I had a 13-year-old boy who started while he was in junior high school. And when his friends were, and by the way, he was a C student, when his friends were freshmen or sophomores in high school, he already had his degree from Fordham, which, you know, if you're into Jesuit schools, it's in a bad place there. You can, no matter what the specialty that requires college credits is, or degrees, you can take those degrees or those credits by correspondence from the greatest schools in the United States at about 40% to a third of the cost of going to the college. Furthermore, the degree or the credits aren't stamped by mail. They're exactly the same degree that Harvard gives if you go to Harvard. Now, that suggests something to you. Or Stanford, or Cal, or the New York State system, which is excellent. Yes, ma'am. He took 2 years of college credits, beginning in junior high school. So I guess he got the second year when he was at the end of his freshman year in high school. And then the college, after seeing that he had 2 years of work, took him in as a student. And they said that he would get his high school diploma at the same time he got his college degree. And I remember, now it just came to me, my daughter was furious. When she got to MIT, she said, this place is hoaching with kids who went to high school from the back of those match packages. You know, get your high school diploma by mail, and they're 12, 13, 14 years old, she said, and MIT didn't have any trouble taking them in. But get Baer's book, get the real Baer's book from Baer himself. It's only legal for him to sell the real one by mail order. I don't know his address, but I do know that his name's in the phone book, and it's Benicia, and you can call him up and you'll have it. Give him an extra $3, he'll send it priority mail, and you'll have it. And then sky's the limit. You want a couple of PhDs? You want a law degree? B-E-A-R, Dr. John Baer. Say that one more time. Oh, how about a PhD from the London School of Economics, where Mick Jagger went? Sure, absolutely. It's Baer's guide to alternative, no, that's it, someone says it back there, to non-traditional, but they're not, they're the same degree from the same school. I mean, it's a non-traditional way to get them, that's all. You do it yourself. Let me repeat what this young fellow's saying here. He took the Shelter Institute course in Bath, Maine, which all by itself is a trip. Bath is so nice, isn't it? It's 3 weeks? Okay, so they do it a lot of different ways, but then they have one straight three-week thing. They'll teach you to build a post and beam house, and if you stay an extra week or two, you know, they'll add plumbing or foundations or whatever to it. It's one family, and as the kids grew up, they've joined the business. I was the keynote speaker for their 25th anniversary 3 years ago, and I'll tell you, in a room this size, the walls were covered with houses built by bus drivers or psychiatrists. The people were transported by the act of building their own house. So the question here partly was, why doesn't this idea catch on? Well, if you drive out on Cape Cod to Wellfleet or to Provincetown, I mean, you'll see hundreds of homes built in the 18th century and then early 19th century that are just breathtaking. They weren't built by architects. I mean, they were built by people who decided, well, I got some time on my hands, I'll build a house. If you come to where I am over in New York State between Ithaca and Cooperstown, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is, the new stuff, the, you know, it's $250,000, is all pre-cut lumber, and the truth is you can't look at it for very long. It's not that it's ugly, it's just not. But these frame places with the turned spindles and the eccentricities are everywhere, and they were built by the people who lived in them. There, could we restore, pardon? The Shelter Institute in Bath, Maine, and if you have your house in hand, you can walk down the street and there's the Maine Boat Building Institute, and they'll teach you how to build a Boston Whaler, a dory, and a skiff. You build three boats in 8 months. And that's how you learn to do it. That's not bad, so as you walk out of Bath, Maine, towing your house over one shoulder and your three boats over the other, and your total tuition, well, your tuition was about $700, $800, like that, and at the Boat Building Institute, it's I think, $800 or $1,000. Come on. Everybody could have these things. The United States is as close to empty. When I was a boy, you couldn't drive anywhere as there weren't people. You go through the Catskill Mountains, and there was one homestead next to it. There weren't any forests. Everybody's gathered into 50 urban areas now. The country's emptier than it's ever been. I have 113 acres over in a beautiful area of New York State, and anyone here who had a paper route could have bought it. It was $500 down and $90 a month for 7 years. At 6% interest. Why was it so cheap? Because nobody wanted to live there. That's why they wanted to go to the big city and, I don't know, go on welfare. I don't know why they wanted to go to the big city. But right now, as we talk, here's a project your kids could do. Pick the state, Massachusetts, New York, and send a postcard to every county clerk in every county in the state. So in New York, there's like 75 counties, so it's 75 postcards. And ask for the tax sale lists when they're posted in the summer. An enormous number of people, and this is hard to believe in the United States, simply get tired of owning something, cancel, and they just walk away from it. That's one way it gets in tax sales. Another way it gets in tax sales, people die without heirs and they're too mean to leave it to anyone else, so they go into tax sales. You can buy virtually at all times spectacular land. It may not have a hard road, but God knows in this part of the world it's stone about a quarter of an inch down anyway. And it may not have developed water, but that's not very difficult to get. I own my land as part of a class session I had where I was trying to show a mixed class, which included some poor kids, that in a country like this, when people get bored, they give away great value. And I said, for example, if you find areas of the country where land isn't fashionable, land will be given away, or as close to it as possible. So I took a Sunday New York Times ad lib, and I just opened it. I said, let's read down this list. And then about the fourth one I read was Tumbling Waterfall Retreat, 99 acres, more or less, $500 down. And I said, if this was a strip mine would be worth that. And so the kids said, well, if it's so good, why don't you buy it? I said, tell you what, I'm going to get down to the payphone right now and tell the guy that I'm going to buy it. And I called up and I said, I'm going to wire the money up. And they asked me when I was going to come up to look at it. The third and fourth sons who couldn't, you know, they didn't get anything. And of course, they did horrible things to the Indians. But certainly, it's the most potent nation on earth, not because of the CIA, but because common people were allowed to do very, very uncommon things. The boot was off their neck, and they understood that they could feed themselves and clothe themselves and teach themselves to read. This was far and away the most literate nation the world had ever seen. And when Alexis de Tocqueville came here in 1835, he didn't like a lot of what he saw, but he said there never again can be a theory that says people distribute themselves over a bell curve, because the country has contradicted it by the behavior of these common people. I mean, even today, there's no competition against the United States in the world. Japan doesn't invent anything. They do develop. Germany doesn't invent much. And this is the source of 82% of the patents on the planet are patented here. It's as if that energy that was loose in the land is still staggering along, even when many people want to rein it in. Well, hey, enough speeches there. But are there practical? We got John Bear. I would teach my kids, but I've got to step away from this. I would teach my kids that the only way anyone knew they were 13 years old was the way they stood. They smiled too much. They carried big floppy notebooks and all this stuff out of the ground. I said, watch what these snotty Columbia kids do when they come down here. They've got a clipboard, and they cock it at a jaunty angle on their hip. We would go through drills like that. One of the drills we used was at the ritziest, or the certainly tied for the ritziest auction gallery in New York City, Christie Manson Woods, which frequently has auctions of really neat stuff like old toys or old comic books, but the kids couldn't get in. And they said they were prejudiced. And I said, that's a working hypothesis. I don't think it's true, but we can test it. I said, describe in front of the class what happens when you try to get into the Christian Union. So the guy said, well, I walk up there and the guard and the guard puts his hand on my shoulder and says, where are you going? And I said, I'm going up to see the comic book. And he said, no kids allowed. And then I picked Danny Sullivan. I said, Danny, go over there and see what happens to you. Because Danny's a white kid. Danny's over and comes back. He says, the guy put his hand on my shoulder and says, where are you going? He says, no kids allowed. Now we're going to run a drill. I brought in a blue blazer with shiny brass buttons. Put this blue blazer on. Now we'll practice.
Walk with a purposeful manner, not as though you're going to be stalked. And when the hand is on your shoulder, I says, freeze. Don't turn around at all. Just freeze.
And then snap around and say, I beg your pardon. They didn't come back for the rest of the day, that team. I'm supposed to ask where young people are going. My mother's upstairs. I'm meeting her. Is there some objection? And I would drill them so they could say it without a stupid kid's grin on their face. Never a problem at all. To get into the sub-treasury in New York, I don't know if it's deliberately. That's where all the money's burned up and the stacks of gold to the ceiling. To get in there, you need one teacher for every 5 students. Well, forget it. I mean, unless you're a ritzy private school, and somebody knows that. But I looked my class over, and I could easily pick out 6 kids who, if they carried themselves a different way, you couldn't tell. And I said, now, what we did drills there for was to you get them to line up in size places. Ralph, you're out of line. Check it off. I mean, we do all these fussy little things teachers did. We were never stopped. We were never. Bronx Zoo is 1 for 15, and I was always going around with 60 kids. Never stopped anywhere. And finally, I came to see that we teach kids signs so they can be identified and put back in their place. But to get rid of those signs isn't a matter of intense study. It's really a matter of saying, I mean, let's show these bastards. That's what it's a matter of. It's a matter of 10 minutes or a half an hour. It's a matter of strategy. And you're people again and not children. You have access to anything. I had 2 shy girls ride with a long-distance truck driver down to North Carolina. I dropped them off in the swamps of Secaucus, New Jersey at 4 a.m. in the morning. There was a dense fog. I was scared. I have a picture of them. I think it's in the newspaper. Just check. My newspaper is here. No. I think it might be here. Harry Payton. Anyway, I dropped them off in there. Where? Oh, yeah, there they are. In first column at the bottom. There they are. A police car came by. They went over and stood next to it to get to be safe. And they say, well, what if the truck driver doesn't show up? I says, well, you're only right across the river from New York. You'll find a bus. You get on the bus, and you'll be in the Port Authority. Then you really have a reason to be scared. Does some of you know the Port Authority bus terminal? It's a creepy place. Is it better now?
Yeah.
I haven't been there for years. Okay. There was something I saw here. These 2 on page 6 are worth looking at. This girl Julie Post here was an absolutely despicable human being. She really was unpleasant to be around. She whined all the time. She came from a rather favored background, but she constantly was worried that someone else got more than her. And she came to me and said that she wanted to apprentice with Sue Simmons, who was the new, as they called them in those days, news hand in New York City, getting $500,000 a year and about 30 pounds lighter than she is now. She really was dynamite on Channel 4 in New York City. And she said, I said, boy, that's a tough one, because if they let anybody in there at all, it's going to be private school kids. I said, but the best way to do it is not to approach the network, because they will absolutely say no. It's to find out where Sue Simmons lives, and then to begin leaving little gifts for her, boxes of brownies, flowers, and be relentless. Never not have something there every week, you know, and then we'll soften her up and leave little pathetic notes saying that you want to do a slide sound show of the operation of the NBC newsroom
and you want to put it out on the circuit so that every school in Community School District 3, that's the Upper West Side, will have a copy to refer to, the life of a news hen or whatever, like this. And one day, just like the Yoko Ono story, I got a call, and a voice that was as hard as diamonds said to me, "Is this Mr. Gatto?" "Yeah." She said, "This is Sue Simmons. You send the little bitch over, and I never want to hear from either one of you again." Mind you, I told you, I said, this is a rotten, wretched thing to do to fellow human beings. You know, it's as bad as building a Beatles memorial in Central Park. Instead of grass, you get to walk on the bronze letters of Beatle lyrics. Look. Oh, did it change Julie? The big catch in my class was Danny Sullivan, who's in this newspaper. He was apprenticed to Lieutenant Governor Cuomo. Danny's a big, shaggy Irish kid. He was, and of course, he wouldn't give the time of day to somebody like Julie Post. But 3 years later, I ran into them on the street. Julie had utterly changed, not whining at all. She had caught Danny Sullivan, who was in college somewhere. I can't remember the college there. I could tell they were definitely an item, you know, for the long haul there, and I didn't have to ask. Understanding that you have power, that you're acceptable, is magic for kids. You don't really have to do much after that. They do it for themselves. Look at Robert Hooper. Same page. Robert Hooper was easily the most talented actor I ever saw. He ran the talent show that traveled around, and he applied to Performing Arts High School and was turned down on the basis of a 4-minute interview, and really turned down because he had excessive absences in junior high school. I mean, what kind of nonsense is this? I mean, Robert was multi-talented at everything. He was in tears when he came to me, and he was a pretty tough kid. I said, you don't have to accept the school's decision. Their vulnerability lies in the fact that they dictate your future on the basis of 240 seconds when thousands of kids are lined up. From their point of view, procedurally, that's all they can manage, but they don't have a leg to stand on if you challenge their decision on the basis of that. I said, but don't write a letter to them because they'll throw it in the wastebasket. I said, go out and get a petition with thousands of names on, not challenging that you didn't get in, challenging that the decision is made on the basis of a, you know, 4-minute or a 2-minute interview. Oh, thank you. The first person, or one of the first persons to sign his petition, was Tim Curry, who was Amadeus in the Broadway show.
How did he get that?
Well, because the West Side, any of you from New York know the West Side? And the West Side is, that's the bedroom for publishing and television and the theater and everything. And for me, it's my bedroom. So anyway, he got this petition. And when the challenge, which is totally effective legally and is designed to catch the attention of the media, right? When the challenge was posed, not as a challenge, but as a possibility, immediately Performing Arts said they were willing to reschedule an audition. I said, Robert, you don't even have to show up. He wouldn't go. He wouldn't go. Isn't that...
They admitted him.
He wouldn't go. He took the audition, passed, and he wouldn't go. I think he had been hurt in some sense of honor he had, that all his life, who he was recognized, even by people who didn't like him, He was just electric with the... he wasn't an Eddie Murphy type, but the way Murphy is, if you see a very bad film called Men in Black, there's a nice guy who's an Eddie Murphy imitator there, and I was trying to figure out what he lacked, because he's handsome and he's sort of funny, and you know, anybody would like to hang out with him, but he lacked that dangerous vitality that Murphy has, like the mind is always looking around him. Oh, by the way, one of my kids was an apprentice to Eddie Murphy, and how did he get to be an apprentice? I didn't set you up, I just remembered it. It was Shoemaker. If you get the one sheets out, and up in the upper right-hand corner, Shoemaker's Lonely Battle, this boy, who was definitely a tough customer, he was not retained by any school teacher who ever lived. But I spoke to, outside of the class setting, almost everybody's a human being. And I said, you know what really bothers me? It's not that you're such a pain in the ass. It's that you're wasting all this time. I'll grant you that this is not worthwhile for you, but what would be worthwhile? And he then admitted that he'd go into amateur night at the comedy club, but he thought he'd gone as far as he could go on his own without having a coach. And I said, well, who would you want as a coach? He said, Eddie Murphy. I said, forget it. On the other hand, I said, the only way it's to be possible, and it's got to be 100 to 1,000 to one shot, is to find out. No, to find out when he arrived, he had some gig in New York, when he arrived, I think it was Saturday Night Live, was he on the Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. In those days.
I said, you got it, and another kid who's now got a beachfront home out in Seattle, did this to Woody Allen, when he was making Annie Hall, we read in the newspaper said, Alan got up at 4 a.m. in the morning to walk alone on the beaches of East Hampton. I said, this is your opportunity, Mark. You've got to get out to East Hampton, which is about 140 miles from New York City. You've got to get up at 3 in the morning, and as Alan comes down the beach, he'll see a little figure walking toward him. It'll be you. No one else will be out there. You are away from Woody Allen. And he ended up hired to do speech balloons. Woody Allen used to have a national comic strip. He ended up hardly, but I mean, he cheated blind. He got $25 a speech balloon for $40. His name is Mark Billgrave. Don't tell him. A great sense of privacy. All these stories pouring out are meant to show you how easy it is to do, but it's not easy to overcome your own training. I had the same training. It happens bit by bit, incrementally. You've got to get the help of your kids. They'll show you a little bit how to do this. They'll be frightened too, because even though they don't go to school, they know people who go to school. They know what it's supposed to be like, what you're supposed to behave like 10 or 12 or 14. Oh, I guess they kept you over time, don't you? Thank you very much.